Hey Caffeinators, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses, hosted by myself, Dave Cowan, and my good friend Jeff Backus. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the veterinary field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question, comment, or would like to be a guest on the Vet Tech Cafe, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com, or you can find us at our website, vettechcafe.com. One thing we would ask of you, our listeners, is to rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you're listening to. We're not exactly sure how or why this helps us, but apparently it does. So without further ado, come on in, grab yourself a cup of coffee, and get ready for another episode of the Vet Tech Cafe.
Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. Dave, it's our last show of the year.
Kind of
crazy. We actually survived a full calendar year of continuing to do this. You haven't fired me yet.
Can I do that?
I mean, I feel like you have the opportunity to. I don't know.
I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think I could do this myself.
Yeah. So as we kind of, you know, as we're in now to, let's see, Christmas week and then New Year's the week after, yeah. Obviously in the time of coronavirus here, who hopefully has any big plans, but are you just laying low, hanging out with Robin and...
Yeah, laying low. And, you know, we were planning to go up north to go see my family. However, with everything going on, we decided probably not a good idea. Yeah. Actually, two of the places that I've worked in the last week have had positive test results. So, you know, thankfully nothing that she and I have been in contact with. So just smart to stay home.
Yes.
I don't have any shifts except on, I think Saturday I have a shift. Mm. But for the Christmas day... And Christmas Eve, I'm not working. I had the opportunity to work for quite a bit of extra money, but I'm not going to do it. Taking my work-life balance and taking the focus on myself this year and just not working.
Absolutely. That's excellent. Excellent.
What are you guys doing? I know you got family out there now.
Yeah, I do. And, you know, my parents and Molly's parents are kind of in our bubble. They both live within like 5 minutes of us.
Yeah.
And so we're just going to go over to my parents' house in the afternoon. It's in the 80s here. So we're just going to sit outside and have sandwiches and,
nice.
You know, still be socially distanced and what have you, but we'll still at least be able to get to see them on Christmas. So that'll be nice. It's supposed to be, you know, still a nice day. So, and it's, you know, I'm still so kind of early in my training with the Poison Control Center that I have Christmas Day off and I have New Year's Day off.
Nice.
Which is, not by schedule request or anything, but I just think they don't want us noobs on the phone on a holiday.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So early. So, which is completely fair. And
yeah.
I will take that all day. So, so it's kind of nice to, you know, have those days off and not have to fight for them this year.
Yeah.
Which of course
may not happen next year.
No, I was just going to say it means I'll work them next year, but that's okay. Yeah. So that's kind of what we're going to do. Just lay low, keep it quiet, but for sure not a white Christmas this year.
Well, and I think up north they've got snow up there now.
They had a good bit of snow I think last week. So yeah. So I sent you this article that we came across. It was it's by Flourish Veterinary Consulting, and it's actually already kind of made the rounds a good bit on Facebook even more. I've seen it posted now. I think Vet Tech Life posted it.
Yep.
It was in the Not One More Vet Support Staff page as well. I think that's where I saw it. And it's kind of about the title of it, if you're not familiar, is The Shift Veterinary Medicine Needs. And to be honest, when I read that title, I was thinking like hours of a shift. Like what shift
I was thinking that too.
Is that like overnight? Is that day shift? I completely was thinking about this in the wrong way. But it was talking about a shift, like a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
And it was such a really fresh and kind of unique point of view. What did you think?
The analogy is perfect of he plants a tomato seed in Colorado.
In December, I think.
In December and expected it to grow.
Right.
And he kind of made analogies to that and to technicians of saying, how do we expect these young technicians to grow in an environment that they're not intended to grow in? And that's what the shift is that he's talking about, is shifting the paradigm of putting the right people in the right situation. The quote that he posted on LinkedIn, it's time veterinary medicine shifts from preventing burnout to promoting thriving. And
yes.
That is just,
yeah.
I mean, put that on a t-shirt. That is just fantastic.
For sure. For sure. Absolutely. And, you know, he had some really great, and he, you know, he went out of his way, I think, as well to kind of, as you just said, to say this isn't like a finger wagging.
Right. Oh, yeah.
You know, point
yeah.
of view, you know, to, or shaming veterinary leaders or those kinds of things. This is just, you know, ultimately the situation we find ourselves in, and this shift he talks about is we need basically to get away from figuring out how to survive and figuring out how to thrive.
Right.
And it was really interesting point of view. I mean, it's one we've all kind of talked about, but the analogies, like you said, were so spot on, and they just make a lot of sense. And so we'll for sure post this with the notes and
want to
get people to read it, because again, it's not a new thought by any stretch, but it's a new way to kind of look at it.
Yeah,
and
yeah, oh yeah.
I really hope that as time goes by here, the next several years, that things just kind of continue to slowly improve, and you know, we kind of get more in line with this kind of thinking.
Well, I also looked at this and thought this was very closely related to the post that I made last week from the Dalai Lama of it's time to stop pulling people out of the river and start figuring out why they're getting in the river.
Right.
So this kind of goes along that same thought process of let's stop trying to prevent burnout and start promoting thriving and getting things on the right side of it.
Right. Absolutely.
But so, yeah, we'll post this. This is a great article.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll definitely have to look into Flourish Veterinary Consulting a little bit more as well and see if there's any other great content, or maybe even we can, I think his name was Josh, maybe even get him on for a conversation, because definitely sounds like something we'd like to talk about.
Yeah.
So, and
maybe,
actually,
maybe for our mental health series.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe for May and actually not far off from what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, exactly. So, exactly.
So I'm really excited. Today we have Eric Richmond coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. As far as I can remember, Dave, this might be the first non-veterinary technician other than our Vetfolio crossover episode.
But she wasn't a technician.
Yeah, was kind of on their end, but you know, that on their setup. But I think our first non-veterinary technician.
I believe
Which I'm super excited about. He's currently the clinical social worker at the Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine at Tufts University in Massachusetts, where I was working the last 4 years. And he provides counseling and support services to clients, to staff, to students in both the small and large animal hospitals. He graduated from Boston University School of Social Work, where he earned his master's degree in social work. And he's worked as a medical and transplant social worker for 25 years at several teaching hospitals in the Boston area in the human world, a human medical world, before coming to Tufts. All kinds of support that he provides at that hospital, from client support in difficult situations with the grieving process, with, you know, difficulties of financial matters, of course, students, technicians, of course, we have residents and interns and, you know, just a lot of very, very wide ranging different challenges that can contribute to mental health challenges as well. And he is an invaluable resource there. Then, of course, is also in the time of COVID here, been working on a task force addressing mental health and well-being at the school during the pandemic. And so just really, really excited to talk to him. You know, we've talked to a few different people, Dave, who have worked at clinics that have social workers on staff, and they've talked about the incredible benefit that provides and all that goes in with that. So I'm really excited to...
Yeah, well, you were the first person that even told me that was a thing. Like, until you mentioned about Eric being a social worker at Tufts, I was like, I didn't know that was even a thing.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, we've heard it with a few of the larger referral hospitals more recently. And it's, again, such a great resource. And I'm really glad to hear that more and more hospitals are picking it up. I know my wife Molly's hospital in Rhode Island had a partial contract with a social worker as well. And she still talks to her, even though we live in California now. I mean,
that's great.
She developed a really great relationship with her and they still chat all the time. So, Eric, I'm so excited to have you come and chat with us today. Can we get you a cup of coffee?
You know, Jeff and Dave, thanks for having me on. And sadly, I've had to switch to decaf in recent years. And people might say, why bother? But I love the ritual. I love when the cream hits the coffee and makes that swirl. So yeah, anything decaf, I'll take.
We can whip that up. We can definitely arrange that. And again, I know it's, you know, East Coast time. I know it's getting early evening anyhow. So
I'm still having coffee.
Yeah. So we always start out with our guests to take us through their career path. And I gather yours is going to be one we for sure haven't heard before. But kind of take us through, you know, what got you into social work, kind of how you worked through the human network of that. And then, you know, what I'm really excited to hear is how you came to Tufts, how that came to be, and what you're doing there.
Sure. So I probably became interested in social work and social justice from my upbringing. My mother was a real activist in New York City back in the 60s and 70s, you know, marching against the city and all the budget cuts and trying to fight for equality and better schools. And so I was dragged along to a lot of those social justice kind of programs and just sort of learned that that was an area that I wanted to be in. I did go to University of Massachusetts Amherst, and my major was political science, and I did a little stint in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill. Felt that it was exciting, but it wasn't my forte. So I found a job that I thought would be very challenging for a social worker, and that was working with recovering heroin addicts, which was fascinating and inspiring, seeing people who, you know, really were down and out in their lives and struggled, and some of them were able to pull it together and have really, you know, full lives after years and years of really difficult drug abuse. From there, I was encouraged by the people I worked with, who were mostly social workers, to go back and get my MSW, which I did at Boston University, and had some wonderful internships. I worked in a district court mental health setting, so folks who would come through the district court for legal reasons, a forensic kind of clinic, and they would need to see mental health or psychiatry. And then I worked in a kind of outpatient family therapy institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where we did lots of couples and innovative family therapy interventions. Really fascinating. From there, I started working in my first job out of graduate school was in a inpatient psychiatric and substance abuse treatment hospital in the outskirts of Boston and Brookline, Massachusetts, and did that for a solid year. It was a great experience working with, you know, pretty significant mental illness and severe substance and alcohol abuse, and learned a lot from that. I then ended up at Boston Medical Center, which was Boston City Hospital back then. And you really see everything at a city hospital. So we had mostly folks from inner city, all sorts of diagnoses. And it was there where I really just loved being in a teaching environment. There was a teaching hospital, and I loved being around multi-disciplines, doctors and nurses and physical therapists and psychiatrists and social workers. And I just found that fascinating to have that multidisciplinary input in treating a patient. And my career then stayed in large teaching hospitals, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, where I became a transplant social worker, working on a transplant team, really innovative team that was sort of the first, they did the first liver transplant in New England back in the 80s.
Oh, wow.
And then they did the first live donor liver transplant back in the 90s, in the late 90s. So it was a really cutting edge team with amazing people. And again, that multidisciplinary teaching environment was so exciting to me. And that's where I spent a good part of my career, just about 20 years as a liver and kidney transplant social worker, evaluating people who were in need of liver and kidney transplants and making sure that on various aspects, they were stable enough to go through transplants. So looking at their support system, their mental health system, their sobriety, if drugs and alcohol were involved, and then they're, you know, just supporting them through the whole process from waiting for transplant, getting a transplant, recovering in the hospital, and then trying to get back to, you know, to a lifestyle that they were accustomed to. I can talk forever about liver disease and liver transplant and organ donation, but that's maybe for another podcast, another topic.
That's not even something that I think about, liver transplants and kidney transplants and things like that, or mental health never even entered my mind as something that's something that they need.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, hearing that you were on that team, that blows my mind, and that's so progressive and forward thinking. That's just, that's awesome.
It really was. And you know, the role of mental health in transplant is crucial, because the surgeons can put in a liver in 4 hours, but to keep that liver healthy for the rest of your life, you have to really have a lot together and a lot of support. And so the team that evaluated patients would look very closely at my evaluations and listen to my recommendations, because they knew that it was much more of a holistic approach to getting somebody from critically ill with end-stage liver or kidney disease to a point where they could, flourish again in their lives.
And then how did it come to be that you transitioned out of the human medical world into Tufts?
Yeah, great question. So I love transplant. I could have stayed there, but I was looking to, challenge myself. Again, I feel like I'm a lifelong learner, and I wanted to learn something new, do something different. And fortunately, Tufts Cummings School had a medical director at the time that was really pushing for a social worker. And I think over the years, it wasn't in the budget and it was sort of put off. And finally, it made it to the budget and they were really forward thinking. And I ended up being the first social worker, veterinary social worker in New England. We now have at least two others in Massachusetts who do what I do. And we sort of, we support each other and help each other and trade techniques and strategies and things like that. So I ended up, knowing very little originally about the veterinary field and spent, at least the first 6 months to a year just immersing myself in veterinary medicine and veterinary education, because we have a thriving veterinary school here with about 425, 450 students. And so it was just a fascinating field to learn. And I also realized that it was also a very much a multidisciplinary approach to taking care of patients, and very much being in a school, a very much a learning environment where there's always education, seminars and programs and webinars, whatever. There's always something going on at our school where you can learn different aspects of the field. And with liver disease, I learned a great deal about end-stage liver and kidney disease. Probably at the height of my career, I knew more than the average primary care doctor because I was so immersed in it and I did some education
right,
for clients.
Yeah, yeah.
And I ended up doing the same thing. I mean, because I'm a social worker, I still am very interested in the medicine behind all of this. And I want to know a little bit about what the diseases are and how you treat the diseases. And so I ended up learning a whole new field of veterinary medicine and getting an idea, because when you work with clients, you really do have to have some basic understanding of what the medicine is.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not advanced like you guys or like the doctors, but, a basic fundamental understanding. So I have some idea, what we're dealing with. Are we talking about, an end stage situation here, end of life? Are we talking about something that's potentially curative, chronic versus acute, that kind of thing.
Gotcha.
Eric, this may just be my ignorance. I'm going to put it under the guise of maybe our other listeners don't understand, but it's really me that doesn't understand. What exactly does a social worker do?
Yeah, so a social worker wears many, many hats. And, I'd say before I even answer that question, one of my challenges was to make the veterinary field that I work with, the techs and the assistants and the staff and the doctors, feel comfortable approaching me and feel comfortable presenting me to a client. Because for many people, social worker term indicates I'm going to investigate you and take your children away, or I'm going to, assess your mental health. And, they associate mental health with the stigma of something being wrong with them or broken.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to do a lot of education just within the field of what social workers can provide. And sometimes I encourage people to, if they felt not too comfortable, I encourage them not to even use the word social worker if they wanted to. Now, I think it's important to use the word social worker, and I let clients know that. But sometimes I say to people who are working directly with the clients, techs or doctors, I say, well, present me as, we have somebody on our team who specializes in fill in the blank, end of life discussions, support around making difficult decisions, talking with children about death, dying, that kind of thing. And sometimes that's just a nicer way to approach it and puts everybody at ease. So what do? I work directly with clients who bring their animals into the hospital. Some of them are really struggling with making very difficult decisions. It may be decisions about continuing aggressive care versus palliative care. It may be decisions about end of life. It may be decisions, financial decisions. Are they making financial decisions that are really going to harm them in the long run? We spend a lot of time talking through these decisions. Sometimes time that the doctors or the technicians don't have because they're so busy working with the patients. And it's nice to allow me that time to free them up and allow the client to really talk through these decisions and see it from different angles. And I think often when you talk through decisions, you are making informed decisions, and that helps long term, because a lot of what we see is guilt. We see a lot of guilt that clients feel when they make decisions, whether that guilt is justified in the sense in their mind, like they left the gate open and the dog was hit by a car. It was an accident, but you know, they can say, I left the gate open. Or it's completely unjustified, you know, an illness that they would never be able to pick up on their own and diagnose, and the animal was perfectly fine, and all of a sudden it's, you know, has a hemoabdomen, and right. It's, you know, critical at the end of life, possibly, or needs surgery. So there's a lot of guilt involved, but when people can talk through these decisions, I think it frees them up a little bit. And so that's a lot of what I do with clients. A lot of work with children, either directly with children who have never experienced loss and death, or with their parents on how to talk to children about loss and death. I think, you know, very much we live in a society where we kind of shun the word dying and death, and we're avoidant of that. And it's not always a good message for children. And if we can talk to children and sometimes include them, depending on their age and their maturity, include them in the decision-making process, that can be very powerful. And it can really leave a very positive impression on children and not make them fearful of death or dying, and make it something that is part of the life cycle. I also work a lot with students who might be struggling with anxiety, things like imposter syndrome, and as a resource for them, either to talk with them or if they need sort of really ongoing therapy, we have some great therapists on our campus through our student assistance program. And I do the same with staff. If staff are struggling with things like burnout or anxiety or depression or difficult conversation with a colleague, how do you start that conversation? Or difficult conversations with clients. Sometimes our staff, you know, struggle with the idea of setting limits when a client can sometimes be overboard in terms of, you know, using language or being a little verbally abusive. You know, understanding that the client is high emotion and feeling very scared and fearful, but sometimes people resort back to that sort of threatening, angry, blaming mode, and you know, it pushes people's buttons. And so work with staff on how to talk with clients, de-escalate things, deal with conflict and things like that. I do work with house officers as well, you know, interns and residents who are just dumped upon with, you know, loads of work and
and
you know, very little outlet, particularly this year with such lack of connection and support, you know, direct support. Everything is so disconnected.
Sounds like you're a very busy man.
Yeah, these days I am a very busy man, but I like it. I thrive on that.
And
I sometimes in human hospitals, social workers have been around for a long time, and you know, in some cases that they can be taken for granted or not always appreciated. In the veterinary world, I can't tell you how much appreciation people give me and express to me that I'm, you know, available on the team, available for them to come to, available to intercede with a client, whatever it may be. There's just, you know, it's wonderful to have a team that, you know, wants you there and likes you and appreciates your value. So I'm here to stay for a while. That's for sure.
Fantastic.
That's great. It sounds like you're doing a great service for them. And now thinking about 2020, the wonderful year of 2020. So how has everything that's gone on this year really affected what you can do? I would imagine you're probably used to going into an exam room and sitting down with the clients and talking with them. I'm imagining you're not allowing people into the hospital. So do you have to do that over the phone? Do you do that over Zoom? Or how do you approach that and get the same results out of that?
Yeah, no, really good question. And yeah, absolutely. Our hospital, everything is drop off. There are no clients allowed in the hospital. And, you know, clients really struggle with that, understandably. But I think our administration made a good decision, because we're, you know, we're seeing cases in the community everywhere now. You know, we're really feeling that spike. Fortunately, we've been able to keep any staff members at a very minimal or students very minimal COVID exposure. So we've done a really, really good job at the school. The dean has been excellent. We have on-site testing.
Yeah.
We have really strict protocols. So it's hard for clients and it's hard for staff not to have that direct contact. You miss a lot. But, you know, I do a lot of phone calls, and in some cases I do Zoom with some family. I've done some family interventions where families are in different places and they've all been able to Zoom in, and we've talked about it. You know, a few cases related to behavioral issues in the animal and trying to make tough decisions about that. And, you know, there may be a son off at college and another son living somewhere else, or a daughter here and there. And so, you know, Zoom is nice in being able to bring people together. So I do a lot of phone consultation. There's a few clients that I've met with because we do allow one client in at a time to do if they're doing a euthanasia. So it's very limited. It's not a very big room. So I might meet one-on-one with that client, giving them distance, both wearing masks. So a little bit of that personal interaction, but I miss that. Because, you know, there's so much that you miss in terms of emotion and body language and facial expressions and giving somebody a hug. Sometimes somebody just needs a hug.
Yeah.
I remember last year I had a guy who, you know, he was like 260 pounds, all muscle, tattooed up. And he's like, dude, I just need a hug. I'm really sad. I never thought I would have these emotions so strong. Yeah. Saying goodbye to my dog. And so, you know, gave him a hug. And sometimes that's what people... So I miss that. I also do a Zoom support group. It's a monthly support group for people who have lost a pet, an animal. Anyone from a horse to a, you know, to a lizard, to a dog, to a cat, whoever, anyone is invited who is a client of Tufts. And at first it was a little choppy because, you know, it's hard to run a group with 8 or 12 people and you're seeing different faces and who talks first and, you know, all of that. But, you know, now that we've been running since the spring, the groups run quite well, and it's a really wonderful mutual support that people are still getting from Zoom. And we have some people who've been with our group for months and even over a year, and other people who are brand new, and having that mixture and that support and knowing where people have been and walking in their shoes, it's a wonderful way to support people who are really grieving and have lost that connection with their animal. So it's challenging, but I think both myself and everybody on our team has risen to the challenge and really been able to continue offering the amazing care that is offered here at Tufts. I have to say, though, I didn't get a chance to say this. When I first came into this business and I walked into the emergency room, because I like to spend a lot of time in emergency and critical care. That's where the action is. That's where you get the heartbeat of the hospital, right?
Yeah.
And you know what's going on with the animals. You know what's going on with the staff. But the first time I saw some technicians putting in an IV into this puppy that was like the size of my palm, I was floored. I was sold. I was like, this group of people, and I was used to nurses, of course, so I didn't know right away that a technician was basically a nurse in a human hospital. I was like, this group is amazing. These people are amazing. And technicians have never ceased to amaze me in the work that they do, and veterinary assistants and animal care attendants. I mean, they work tirelessly behind the scene. And a lot of times that's what I say to clients. I say, you know, I know it's really difficult not to be able to go in and see, but let me tell you, I work with this staff day in and day out, and these folks treat your animal like their own. The love, the connection, the care is beyond words. But putting that IV into a puppy was like a slam dunk. Like what? Like watching Michael Jordan, you know, fly in the air and slam that ball down, and your jaw drops. How does somebody do that? Amazing. And then, of course, working with, you know, animals that I would be running from, and you're getting right down in their face, and every day I see that, and I'm still like, holy cow.
Yeah.
You know, I feel the hairs going up on my back, and they're like right there doing treatment. So hats off to you guys. I really mean it. You guys sold me on what you do the minute I saw that.
Oh, thank you.
That's fantastic.
And then now that we're at the end of 2020, thankfully, Now we're getting into the holiday season, and we posted today about seasonal depression on our Mental Health Mondays post.
Yeah, sure. Today's first day of winter.
Oh, yeah. Today's the first day of winter, too.
Yeah. Shortest day of the year.
So I suffer from seasonal depression. I know there's many others out there that do that. How do we combat that? How do we get over that? Or do we get over it?
Yeah. I don't know if you get over it or, you know, you get through it. And just like we've gotten through the last 9 months, you know, what percentage of the last 9 months have we gotten through? 100%, right? So you know you can do it, even in the hardest days and the darkest days. There's obviously talking with a therapist, talk therapy, connecting, even if it's with Zoom. People all the time tell me, you know what? I had stuff bottled up inside that I didn't even know I was experiencing for these past 9 months. And just by talking about it, it's sort of like I feel lighter. There's a weight off. You know, people sometimes as a defense, they suppress that stuff and try to find a closet or a box or a rug to put it under. But ultimately, it's going to rear its head. So having an outlet, and it doesn't have to be a therapist. It can be a trusted colleague, somebody, a close friend. Sometimes a therapist is good because it's really, you know, somebody who's very, doesn't know you well. It's somebody who's very objective and you can really open up to them. You know, getting sunlight. The days are shorter. Getting sunlight is crucial. Sometimes, I don't know if you've ever used light therapy, but there's certain light therapy boxes and that you can use that give you that sunlight for, you know, 30 minutes a day, whatever it is, that can counteract seasonal depression disorder. Being active, you know, there's a lot of studies out there that, you know, exercise is for some people is comparable to an antidepressant. Now, that's not in everybody, so don't throw your antidepressants away if you need them. The antidepressants are very useful. To me, I like to describe them as you're stuck in mud and you're in a Jeep and you have regular tires. Antidepressants are those big knobby tires that you throw on and they're going to get you out of the mud. They're not going to maybe get you all the way, but they'll get you out of the mud. So those are some of the things you can do. And obviously you need connection. We can't isolate ourselves. If we isolate ourselves, we're just going to get more and more into our thoughts. And sometimes those thoughts are dark. So having an outlet, whatever it is, a group of people you can talk with or chat with, and it can be a colleague, whoever that is, it's going to be crucial to getting through these dark seasons.
Gotcha. You know, one question I think about, and I do know a few actually that were former veterinary technicians that have transitioned into the human medical world. And actually we had one of my former colleagues on the show earlier in the year as COVID was really kind of taking off. She's now a critical care RN. And one question I want to ask you is now that you've been in the veterinary side for a little while, in terms of mental health needs or challenges, do you see any notable similarities or differences between veterinary technicians you interact with currently and the RNs you used to work side by side with?
Yeah, absolutely. I did a lot of work in surgical ICUs, obviously, because some of our patients would end up in the surgical ICU after a transplant or medical ICUs before transplant. And so one of the things I saw, particularly in those nurses, and I think there's a parallel to technicians, is moral distress, burnout and moral distress. So, you know, the definition of moral distress is the inability of somebody to act according to his or her own values and perceived obligations due to internal or external constraints. And, you know, there's always going to be internal and external constraints when you're working in a critical care setting. And so, you know, sometimes decisions are made that, you know, just don't meet your values and beliefs, and yet you still have to take care of that patient and you still have to work as a nurse or a technician. And so I think moral distress is one of the key areas that there is an overlap. And one of the key areas in veterinary medicine in general that I think is so crucial to address. And one of the ways we address it is we have regular ethics rounds where we take a case that may have been an ethical challenge for somebody. And in our hospital, anybody can bring that case. It doesn't have to be a doctor. It can be a technician, a doctor, a staff member, a student, whoever, and present the very basic medical piece. And then what they see is the moral or ethical dilemma. And then we work through it using some of the ethical principles that are out there, things like justice and benevolence and non-maleficence and things like that. And we work through the case And no right or wrong, no judgment. It's just, what are different angles of seeing this ethical dilemma? Can you put yourself in the shoes of, say, the client who's making a decision that you don't agree with? And what are they going through? And so I think those ethics rounds really help people deal with the, when they're faced with the, you know, in the moment, in the reality of ethical decisions, you know, of do you keep a dog on a ventilator or not? Is this futile care or is it not? And how do I work in my job if I think this is futile care? And I think what overlaps between nurses in a human hospital and in a veterinary hospital is that you're all both exposed to death and suffering and sometimes feeling powerless and end-of-life decisions, having to have good communication with the team and the doctors, and working with families who and clients with high emotions. And I think those are very, very similar. I think both professions deal with that all the time. And what we really need to do is we need to have an outlet for that. And I think, you know, there's nurses in critical care settings form groups and discussion groups. And I think technicians should too, where people can be heard and validated. Doesn't mean it's going to necessarily change the outcome, but it's a forum where people can be heard and validated and discuss some of these struggles that they're dealing with.
That's such a fantastic idea. Yeah,
I don't know that I've ever really heard the phrase moral distress before, but that makes so much sense.
Yeah, I'll give you an excellent article that was written for ICU nurses in a human hospital. I think it came out of Temple University in Philadelphia. And this article was actually mentioned to me by Lisa Moses. I don't know if you know her name. She used to work at Angel in Boston. She was their palliative care doctor expert and also very much an ethics expert in the field of veterinary medicine. But this was a great article. It's called Reflective Debriefing, a social work intervention addressing moral distress among ICU nurses.
Oh, yeah.
And I've kind of used this article to think about our ethics rounds and also to think about how can I bring this type of group support to technicians in a critical care setting. And we were really close to starting that program, and then boom, 2 weeks before we're going to start, COVID hit and everything went up in flames. But someday we'll get back to it. And we've done a little bit on Zoom, and also we are fortunate now to have Michael Santaseri, who's a critical care nurse who is now the coordinator for education and development for technicians in our hospital. And so we're teaming up on doing really short videos, maybe 5 or 10 minutes, on various mental health topics. And we pick videos because of the times. And we also pick the short videos because we know that people aren't going to always have time to you know, spend 30 minutes or 45 minutes. So short topics like de-escalation with somebody who's worked up, or how do you build work life into your daily routine, or coping with anxiety, or coping with moral distress. So those are going to be some of the topics that we're going to bring via video and share it with our technician crew here at Tufts.
So, Eric, having worked for so many years in the human field and over the course of your whole career, and especially with 2020 going on, have you seen any big changes in how mental health for healthcare workers is viewed within the medical profession? I realize that, you know, the frontline workers right now are right at the forefront with everything that they've been dealing with. And veterinary technicians are kind of in that same boat, but not quite to the level that human medical professionals are. Have you seen a big change in that before COVID? And what has been the reaction to that since COVID? I guess that's a two-part question.
Yeah, so before COVID, I think the big boat turned slowly, and I think we were making some headway in, at least in the veterinary field. I think things were changing. People were more accepting of mental health issues and addressing them and being part of the dialogue, the discussion, and just by hiring social workers and including social workers and other mental health professionals in the field, we have quite a few now. That to me indicates that the sort of the lens is changing, the paradigm, as you talked about earlier.
Yeah.
I loved your quote that we got to go from preventing burnout to promoting thriving. And that's music to my ears, because that's really something that we're trying to promote, at least on our campus and our hospital. And since COVID, our dean had the very good idea to pull together a mental health and well-being working group to help address a lot of the special circumstances of mental health and COVID. And so I now chair a mental health and working group for our entire campus, where we're coming up with a strategic plan and implementing some programs and discussing how we can make mental health and well-being a prominent part of the veterinary profession and our school and our students. And I think you have to start early on. I think, you know, if you wait until you feel like you're set in your career, that's too late. You have to start as a student and even early on in your career and build in periods of well-being and mental health and practice them and make them part of your everyday occurrence, just like going to work. You know, mental health and well-being is part of that. Because I think if you wait until you quote-unquote need it, or until you're stable in your career and everything's all set, it's really, really difficult, which may never happen. And it's really difficult to put into practice something that you've never been used to. So I'm constantly talking to our younger doctors and students and professionals about building in well-being to their everyday practice. That might be setting limits and boundaries on what they can do. You know, you were talking earlier about you could have worked on a holiday and made a lot of extra money, but, you know, you decided you were going to have some time for yourself and your family. And, you know, that's real important. That's a big step, I think, that a lot of people have trouble taking sometimes. You know, setting boundaries on external boundaries, on people who are putting too many demands on you, and then internal boundaries, telling yourself, okay, I've reached my threshold and I need to take a break. And that's the problem. Sometimes people are not, they push their threshold further and further out that they're not even aware of where they're at in terms of how stressed and difficult it is. And then it becomes that much more difficult to reach for help and to intervene and help themselves.
You know, talking about getting this going in early in your career, and I've said this for a number of things, for so many things that pertain to veterinary technicians and veterinarians, so much of it starts in school and starts when they're students, all kinds of different things. Thinking about when you're interacting with students, interns, residents, how is your presence perceived by veterinary staff? Do you feel like you're well received and your role is well received? Are people specifically in the veterinary technician profession, are we open to suggestions, or do you find us to be closed off in general? How is that relationship coming to be so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the majority of interactions that I have, technicians have been wonderful. And you can see it in their face. They're really appreciative that I've had some intervention with a client. You know, you can see that they're stressed, that maybe they're exacerbated by the client or by an interaction with another colleague, and they just don't always know where to turn. And when I'm present, it's a big relief, I think. So I do feel that they value my role and appreciate it. And again, that makes me feel terrific, because I feel like, you know, there's a purpose here. I have a purpose, and it's helping out a really stressed and sometimes challenged staff that is sometimes working short staff, long hours. A lot is asked for them and for them to give. And, you know, sometimes they just don't have that to give anymore. They you know, you're juggling the patient and the client and another, maybe a doctor, and they sometimes just don't have that to give. And so if there's an area where I can intervene and I can sort of take some of that off of them, it works out terrific. You know, like any profession, it takes some people time to warm up and they're not sure, you know, how to approach me. We have obviously some extroverts and some introverts. And so sometimes the introverts have a little more difficult time, you know, coming to me asking for my input or help. But for the most part, I think I'm welcomed on the team and welcome to a presence to be there. Before COVID, I spent a lot of time hanging out in the ER, just watching and asking questions. And sometimes those questions are not, what are you doing with that animal? Why are they sick? But hey, how was your weekend? You know, what's going on with you? Just sort of setting up getting a rapport. And, you know, when people trust you and you can relate to them on that level, then they're going to come to you with more difficult topics that they're struggling with. And that's really my goal, is to, you know, have people trust that I'm going to help them some way or be useful some way in a situation that might be very challenging and difficult.
You know, kind of in that relationship, if a veterinary technician is going to come to you as a social worker and say, I'm struggling, I'm having a hard time with X, Y, or Z, what kind of steps are involved in there? How do you handle that? And how do you get to, I realize that when we're thinking about this, I'm giving you a very vague presentation of this, but what kind of is your role when you're dealing with veterinary technicians that are coming to you with these kind of things?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a whole lot different than anybody coming to me, but now that I have a real appreciation of what veterinary technicians do and what they struggle with and what they get paid, you know, is also important. It's helpful for, you know, that and that's not, you know, that's not a joke. We've you know, a lot of technicians have not been able to get overtime because of, you know, things are tight and a lot of people rely on that. So economically, people are struggling. Mm-hmm. They may have had people in their families lose jobs. So, you know, it's a real struggle. For example, I've had a technician that comes to me periodically, not really often, but, you know, it's sort of like a cycle where they say, look, I'm just feeling burnt out. And really what they need is just to talk. They just need to talk. And, you know, sometimes I give them ideas and suggestions, but I'm just an ear, like just having somebody to be able to listen to them and validate that what they're experiencing is real and it's a struggle and it can be worked through. It's not, you know, it's not the end of the world and the end of their career, and they don't need to, you know, find a new job. We can work through this and find solutions and ways to deal with burnout. But just having that ear and having that really close by, I'm right there. I'm right outside. My office is literally right outside the emergency room. And so if I'm not wandering around, they know where to find me. And or they can, you know, email me, or we can have a conversation over the phone if they're not able to physically come and talk with me. But just being accessible and having that ability to talk things through, I think, makes a huge difference. You know, we do have employee assistance program where people can call up and set up an appointment, either a phone appointment or before COVID in-person appointment with a therapist. But the fact that I'm accessible and that I kind of know what the struggles are, and I know what the environment and the culture is here at our hospital, I think it saves them a lot of explanation, and it makes them feel a little bit more comfortable to talk with me, hopefully. Yeah. Hopefully that's the case. But I have found it's true because, you know, people keep showing up, so something must be going right.
Gotcha. When you, when you're talking with so many different people on so many different levels, from all of the hospital staff to the clients, how are you mindful? How do you manage your own mental health?
Yeah, it sounds like you have a lot to do.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great question coming from a very seasoned technician. I like that question. So I've been doing this for a long time, and I think I'm pretty good at not taking things home with me.
Okay.
And I think that's the key, because when you're really invested in a case and it's really intense, it's really hard not to sometimes take things home with mm-hmm. you and, you know, think about it and second guess maybe your role in it and what you said or did or what you should have done and all of those things. And of course, there's going to be those emotional cases where those happen. And, you know, that's normal. But you need an outlet. And that outlet could be talking to somebody. Look, I just need to talk this through. Can I talk this through with you? I had a really tough case and this is what was going on. And so I have colleagues where I can do that. I rely on my family. I love coming home to my family for the most part, except when my teenagers leave dishes in the sink. That's another story. And we have a dishwasher.
It's all teenagers then, huh?
I don't understand the brain there. Yeah, adults do too. I don't understand the brain between the sink and the dishwasher not making that connection, but that's maybe just me. But nevertheless, you know, I have a family life that I value, that I want to spend time. I know that time is precious. And, you know, they're not always going to be around and close. And so I want to spend that time with them. And I also have a lot of good outlets. For example, Dave was telling me he hates the cold. Well, I hear you. I hear you on that. And the older I get, I don't love the cold either. But hey, it snowed a foot and a half here. I jumped on some snowshoes, went off into the woods. I didn't care about the cold. I was in this beautiful virgin snow, gorgeous trees, you know, pine trees with snow draped over them, the sun. It was like so freeing. And that's what I do.
Well, I will say about the snow that now that I'm not in it, it is pretty.
It's yes, a, right. Every From time a distance,
I,
right?
Yeah. Every time I see snow, all I think about is I'm going to have to shovel all that crap.
Exactly. And sometimes I use mindfulness. I mean, mindfulness is such a common topic now. Everybody's, you know, it's kind of, you know, what's in and everyone's talking about it. But, you know, you don't have to be a yogi. You don't have to be an expert. You can do it even in a few minutes at work. Set yourself down maybe in a quiet area for 2 or 3 minutes, focus just on your breath. Think about clouds passing through the sky as your anxious worries and anxieties, and just let them drift by. And as they drift by, focus on your breath. 2 or 3 minutes is all you have to do. Hmm. And it's amazing how your breath can bring you back down and center you and ground you. Hmm. And you can even do that without sort of a breathing exercise. You can just stop yourself, take a breath, think about what's important, what you want to say, and have an intention to do that. Oftentimes we get so worked up and so caught up in the moment that we don't allow ourselves just to take a second to bring ourselves back to the moment and what's important and what we need to focus on. Simple things like that. Yeah. And, you know, anybody can do that. Literally anybody can do that.
Something that we've been doing the last couple guests we've had is letting you advocate for your job. So for our listeners, why would you?
Oh, is it in jeopardy? Do I know something I don't?
not necessarily your job per se.
I know. I'm
but
kidding.
Your career path. Why would you advocate for a hospital or a group of hospitals or clinic to look into bringing a social worker on staff? What's the benefit that they're going to gain?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. So, again, I think social workers wear many hats, and you know, we can bring all sorts of resources to the table. For example, if you're dealing with a domestic violence situation, a lot of people are not trained on how to do that. Social workers are trained on how to do that. Mm. If you're dealing with somebody who is having suicidal ideation, suicidal thoughts, a lot of people are not really trained on how to deal with that. Social workers are trained how to deal with that. So we bring many, many resources to the table that you wouldn't expect. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not your expertise. Just like I wouldn't know how to put an IV into a puppy, right? And you never would want me to. It's not your expertise. Not to say that you don't have the ability to talk to people in compassionate and empathetic ways. You certainly do. But this is our area of expertise, and it's really something, it's a value added where we can really help both clients who are struggling on all sorts of levels and take the time and patience, and we can also intervene with staff and help staff members who are struggling with all sorts of different areas in their lives, whether it's work-related or something they're bringing from outside of work, and, you know, spend some time in talking with them about and come up with solutions, and solutions that work for them, you know, solutions that fit into their lives. I think there's a role for social work clearly in veterinary medicine, and, you know, I think the field is seeing that because I think even, you know, large corporate programs are bringing on social workers, as well as schools. And I know some of the smaller practices, obviously money is involved, but even if 4 or 5 small practices could pool together their resources and share a social worker, that could work well, just as well.
And you mentioned in there that, you know, you're trained to do that stuff and we're not trained to do that stuff. I wanted to get your opinion on the QPR training that I've actually just recently finished that's available to anyone really for trying to question, persuade, and refer people that are dealing with suicidal thoughts. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think it's a very worthwhile. And again, you're not acting as a therapist.
Right, exactly.
But you're acting as somebody who's going to intervene. And we know from the research that somebody who's, you know, really thinking about suicide, if somebody intervenes just by talking to them, just by asking, are you okay? How can I help you? Here's some resources. That putting that barrier between the thoughts and the actual action is very, very effective in stopping suicide. Hmm. So again, knowing just a few phrases of what to say or how to approach someone and knowing what the resources are and listening in a non-judgmental way, that can be the difference between somebody thinking about suicide and actually taking their own lives.
Yeah.
So absolutely very effective. In addition to that, there's something called mental health first aid, which is offered, and it's very similar to what you're talking about, but it focuses not just on suicide, but on all sorts of things like substance abuse and depression and anxiety and eating disorders. So intervening, knowing a little bit about those areas of mental health, knowing how to intervene, how to listen, and how to encourage them to get help, whether it's professional help or self-help, similar to the training that you're talking about, is extremely effective. And again, I mean, I think I've said this a number of times at our institution, but you know, everyone in our community and everyone in your respective communities has a responsibility for mental health and well-being and suicide prevention. And so anybody can intervene. And I think we don't necessarily just want to leave it to mental health professionals because anybody can intervene to get somebody help.
Yeah.
And that's what's crucial. And I think we all have a responsibility as a community to come together. And, you know, some of these trainings are offered online now. It's very easy to do, just like CPR training, where you get certified, mental health first aid, you can get certified for 3 years and be a mental health first aider. And you never know when you're going to use that. You may use it at work, you may use it in your family, you may use it with a stranger that you come across, and it's extremely, extremely effective.
You never have to use it.
Yeah, hopefully you never have to, but you hope you never have to use CPR, but
you have that skill, and
if you have that skill, it can be life-saving, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And so thanks for bringing that up, Dave.
We've had, as we've talked to a couple different people throughout, you know, we've talked to people. We've had episodes on burnout and compassion fatigue and depression and anxiety in our field and all kinds of different things. And social work has been brought up a few different times. And a couple of technicians that we've talked to have mentioned kind of wanting to investigate that as a career path. So somebody maybe in our field, a lot of people start as veterinary technicians college age. How do they kind of start looking into social work? Where is that a pretty common path at major universities? What's a good recommendation to start somebody down that path if they're interested?
Yeah, well, the good news is now, compared to when I went to school, is now there's a lot of online programs. So you can continue working as a veterinary technician for the most part and get your MSW through online programs. And so I would consider looking at that because it's probably very cost effective for people and you're able to still make an income. Do you lose something? Maybe. Maybe you lose a little bit when you do as opposed to in person. But, you know, I think everybody's getting real familiar and comfortable with, you know, doing Zoom and online stuff. So I don't think it's a big jump. So there's a lot of programs that offer that. Probably the gold standard in our career area for veterinary professionals and social workers is University of Tennessee. They have a program through the veterinary school and through their social work school at Tennessee, so you can become eventually a veterinary social worker. Hmm. And a veterinary social worker is a specific certification, so any social worker can practice in a veterinary setting, but a veterinary social worker gets their degree through University of Tennessee, and they have a wonderful program. Again, you don't have to go through that program. You can get an MSW at any school. There's many schools that offer them. You can just, you know, you can Google MSW programs in your particular state, and they'll come up. But the Tennessee program is wonderful because it really does focus on if you want to stay in the veterinary profession, some of the key issues that are in that area. And those are things like, you know, bereavement and grief and loss, human-animal violence and that connection. They also focus on the human-animal bond, and they focus on, there's one more pillar that's slipping my mind, but it'll come to me.
Probably after we're done recording.
Yeah,
of course, as it always does.
That's super
But
cool.
I would certainly look into that. And I've had some veterinarians who have approached me thinking about going back and getting that degree as well, because they have a desire to really work in the well-being, mental health part of the profession. So I certainly think it's doable. Social work is a very, very useful degree. If you get an MSW, you can practice in many, many different settings. You can eventually do private practice if you choose. So it's really versatile.
That's super cool to hear about that Tennessee program. I didn't know anything like that existed with like a specific veterinary certification in that area.
Yeah, it's a wonderful program. Elizabeth Strand is the director of that program, and she's sort of the founder of that. And she's written, you can Google her. She's written an enormous amount of material on social work and mental health and the profession of veterinary medicine. And she'd be a wonderful guest to have on your program at some point also. She would accept that. She's really very dynamic, a wonderful person.
Wonderful. We'll definitely have to look into that.
Yeah.
Well, as we approach about an hour of recording here, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I do want to, my last question for you is there anything that we haven't touched on in terms of social work and veterinary medicine that you would want to get out to our listeners that maybe we haven't asked you yet?
Yeah, great question. You know, I guess I touched on it a little, but I guess I would say that I really encourage veterinary technicians to, if you have a social worker in your hospital or in your clinic, to really start a conversation with them. Talk with them about what they can bring to your practice. How can they be part of the team? You know, really think about including them in your everyday practice with whether it's with clients or with coworkers or on your team. Think about them as part of the team, because I think that they can bring a really dynamic aspect to how we practice veterinary medicine. Again, I love the multidisciplinary approach. I learn from you guys all the time. I love being around doctors and technicians and the medicine piece of it. I love watching you in action. And I think you can learn from us. I think you can learn some, you know, techniques on perhaps how to de-escalate, on how to care for yourself. So I guess my message is just, you know, reach out, even if it's by email, even if there's somebody that you don't directly work in your program, email a social worker that may be in your community and say, look, I'd really be interested in you coming to our program and talking and doing maybe a presentation and helping us understand a little bit how we can, you know, we can work better, or we can, you know, utilize some of these skills that you're talking about.
Gotcha. And, you know, just as a quick add-on to that as well, you mentioned this early on, and I meant to kind of bring it up then, about, you know, maybe a couple of different hospitals pooling their resources together to kind of quote-unquote share a social worker. And I just wanted to say the hospital my wife worked at in Rhode Island, which is the only multi-specialty referral hospital in Rhode Island, actually did that with a couple of other hospitals. They had a sister hospital, and that actually worked really, really well. I think she was at my wife's hospital maybe 2 days a week.
Sure.
But then she, you know, the other three business days of the week, she was at two or three other hospitals as well. And, you know, I do want to say that type of situation or agreement can work really, really well. And, you know, not every hospital can certainly bring that on as a full-time position, but definitely look in your area, anybody that's listening that's interested, and see if you can kind of work with somebody else, you know, a couple other hospitals, and pool things together. Because I, like I said, my wife worked in that situation and she, you know, it absolutely worked. So
absolutely. And Jeff, it, you know, now it may be even one of the silver linings of COVID is it, you know, you may be able to get somebody to do several hospitals with Zoom type. Intervention.
Everything's virtual now, right?
So maybe even easier than you think.
Yeah.
And, you know, just think creatively. And I think, you know, the possibility is there.
Awesome. Well, I can't thank you enough for your time.
Yes, thank you so much, Eric.
Talking about all this, and because I know so many, I mean, mental health is kind of a recurring theme of this podcast, and we try to talk about a lot of different things with a lot of different people. So to have, you know, a social worker come on and share their point of view, you know, that one that works with our profession so closely is hugely, hugely beneficial. We really, really appreciate the time.
Yeah, well, thank you, Jeff and Dave, and I really appreciate you highlighting the role of social work in our profession.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about it. I think there's so much we can continue to do and collaborate on. I'm just about done with my decaf that you made for me. It was excellent, excellent roast. It must be California.
It's a Southern California blend.
Southern California roast, yes. And the good news is I won't be up all night.
Fantastic.
So that's terrific. I'm going to put on my down jacket now and head out into the snowy New England winter.
All right. Well, we're not going to let you go just yet.
We got one last question.
One
last question.
I don't know how many of our episodes you've listened to, because you're not a technician, but we always end our episodes with a would you rather question. And we've geared this specifically to you since you've lived in both of these regions. And I'm not sure how much of a baseball fan you are, but here we go. Are you ready for your would you rather question?
Bring it on.
All right. Would you rather be a Red Sox fan in Yankee Stadium or a Yankees fan in Fenway Park?
Wow. I can... I never want to be a Yankees fan in Fenway Park. I've experienced that. I've seen it. And so that is not for me. In fact, when my oldest son, who's now 21, was really little, took him to his first game in Fenway Park. And of course, I'm from New York. So I had a New York Yankees hat on him and he had a Red Sox shirt. And I can't tell you the number of people who were screaming at me, "You're confusing that kid. You are confusing him. That's wrong. He's got a Yankee hat and a Red Sox shirt. You cannot confuse that kid. He's going to grow up all messed up." Well, he grew up fine. But
I don't think you confuse the child. I think you confuse the people that wanted to heckle you.
Right.
Maybe that's it.
I don't know which of these things I should be offended by.
Right.
And he was young. He was like 5 or 6.
So. Oh, gosh. Oh, all right. Well, we'll let you go enjoy that cold and that snow. But again, thank you so much for your time.
Yes,
we genuinely
so
appreciate it. And for all the work that you're doing there at Tufts, I know so many people there that have been positively impacted by your work. So from the bottom of my heart, a genuine thank you. I really appreciate what you're doing.
Well, thank you very much. And I wish you both a really safe and wonderful holiday.
Thanks, you as well. And all of you caffeinators as well. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. And we'll see you guys in 2021.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Take care.
Hey, caffeinators. We would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. As you guys are well aware by now, we often talk about difficult issues that face our profession, and we chat with colleagues and leaders in our field who have strong opinions of these issues. Those opinions expressed by either Dave and I as the hosts or those opinions expressed by our guests are their opinions alone and do not represent any other person, any other business or institution or any other entity with or within the scope of veterinary medicine. If you have any questions relating to this, please feel free to email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. You can check out our website, vettechcafe.com. And please, whatever podcast form you're using to listen to our episodes, like us, follow us there, like us and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. And lastly, have a great day, caffeinators. You guys are awesome. Bye, guys.